We're going to jump to Kina Mem Aleph 41, page 360. As we sort of end off, we'll do this one and then two more. There's a lot of history here. If you have the article, you're welcome to read the commentary, the historical background on the bottom. But I wanted to share with you a little bit of research that I did that's, I guess, very appropriate for this year. Here we have a kina written by none other than Marami Rotenberg. Marami Rotenberg was the Rebbe of the Rush and the Mordechai. Basically, much of Hilchas Ashkenaz, some of the halachas of Tisha B'Av Shechal Yosef Shabbos comes from the Marami Rotenberg. And he was from Worms, and somebody just mentioned to me a few minutes ago that when they visited Worms, they went to the Rashi Museum, and it was never there. And the Rashi Museum, there's an exhibit of something really fascinating, but maybe more frightening, that in the time of the 1200s, when Worms was a thriving Jewish city, they had a picture, a depiction, a painting of the city of Worms, almost like a map, but illustrated as a map of Worms, as if it were Yerushalayim. A little frightening to think. The same with the Meshech Chachma comments in the early 1900s on Barashas Bechukosai that those who call Berlin their Yerushalayim, only bad things could come from that. When you feel so comfortable where you live, that makes Hashem angry, because we're not supposed to be so comfortable where we live. And so, here in the city of Worms, we have a kina written by Marami Rotenberg. He wrote this after there was a tremendous gathering of all the Sifrei HaTalmud in France. I want to share with you some of the research that I found. King Philip II expelled all the Jews from France in 1182. But within a few years, Jews began to trickle back into the country, settling in several cities and towns, including Paris. But their activities were severely restricted. The Lateran Council, convened by Pope Innocent III, what a name, in 1215, banned Jews, listen to this, from all professions in Europe, except for being a pawnbroker and selling used clothing. In addition, Jews were forced to wear special, ridiculous clothing that differentiated them from the Christians. And we know exactly what those special garments that the Jews in Paris had to wear. Because those sculptures have adorned the Notre Dame Cathedral for the past 800 years. The Jewish wedding guests in those sculptures are dressed in long robes and all wearing tall, pointy hats. At the time that sculpture was being carved in the Notre Dame, the Jews were relentlessly persecuted in Paris and elsewhere in Europe. In 1239, Pope Gregory IX sent letters to church leaders as well as to the kings of England, Spain, Portugal, enumerating dozens of charges against the Talmud, which led to calls to collect and destroy this Jewish holy work. Nowhere was this horrendous instruction carried out with as much zeal as in Paris. On March 3rd, in 1240, church officials burst into the shuls throughout France. It was Shabbos, and the shuls were full. France's helpless Jews watched as the holy volumes of their Talmud, remember this is 200 years before the printing press, one shas could take months, years to write. There weren't five in a base medrash like we have. Every city maybe had one. A big city maybe a little more than one. French King Louis IX called for the Talmud to be put on trial. Four rabbis, the famous Rishonim, who we learned, defended the Jewish holy books from a series of accusations, and unsurprisingly, the rabbis were found to have lost, and the Talmud was condemned to be burned. And on June 17th, 1242, church officials brought 24 wagons, piled high with volumes of the Talmud, approximately 10,000 books in all, all the known copies of Shas, then existent in France. to a street in Paris called, I'm probably not pronouncing it correctly, Place de Grève, adjacent to the Notre Dame. And there, they were publicly burnt. The Rabbi Meir of Rothenburg, known as the Marami Rothenburg, witnessed the burning at that square in Paris. And he wrote this kina that we're about to read afterwards. Who wonders? I know there were articles like this. If maybe in a certain sense we have the last laugh. They burned our shas 800 years ago. Kadosh Baruch Hu, time is meaningless for him. 800 years is a split second. Kirega ba'apo, chayim b'tzono. Kadosh Baruch Hu wanted to seek vengeance on that fire. 800 years later, perhaps, he sent his fire. That same Notre Dame Cathedral looking down. And in this kina, we talk not just about the Torah being burnt, but those who lived with the Torah being burnt equally. Mem Aleph, page 360, Shalis Rufa Vaish. Shalis Rufa Vaish. Shalom Avilahi. We're heading to the second to last kina, which is the kina written by Rav Shimon Schwab Zatzal about Churban Europa, about the Holocaust, on page 386. It's not numbered. It might not be in the old editions, but in the... I want to share, I don't remember if I said this story in shul or not, but last summer, I went to Poland. I didn't go for a fun trip to Poland. My mother-in-law and father-in-law were driven for decades with a burning question in their minds and in their hearts, wondering one thing. What were all the Polish neighbors share in the Nazi machine's destruction? And my father-in-law was on fire with this question for years, and he was driven to find out the answer, and he decided to take his three children and their spouses, me and my wife and my two brothers and sisters-in-law and their spouses, to Poland to figure out the answer to that question, to go to the towns where they're from, where their family's from, where so many of their relatives were killed. And we got to the town, a small, small town where my father-in-law's family is from, and I saw my father-in-law's eyes almost like a raging fire. And we engaged in conversation. It's a small little, like a hick town, a real hick town. A small, population, 5,000 people now. It's a very old city. It's in a city that had a walled, from the medieval times, there was like an entrance way from medieval times. Very old, the name of the city is just dropping from my mind right now. I don't remember, it was Jikov, Charnikov, but that was my mother-in-law's city. I don't remember if it was my father-in-law's city. And we're trying to engage in conversation every old person we meet. And my father-in-law looks at every old person, any person who looks like they're 80 and above, and with the Polish tour guide says, ask them, did they know any Jews? To their face, do they know any Jews? And throughout Poland, we were, I had my tzitzis tucked in part of the time, I had a hat on the time, but we were in this town, this little hick town, we all had our tzitzis flying, our yarmulkes out, because my father-in-law was on a mission to figure out what was all the neighbors who lived there, and these people who are 80 years old now, who are 9, 10, 11, 15 years old then, what was their part? Were they just innocent bystanders? Maybe. Were they victims? Maybe. Were they perpetrators? And we went to the address where my father-in-law's house used to be. It's an empty lot now. He has the picture. He has the address. And not so far from there, there's a building, I think it's a hardware store if I remember correctly, that the tour guide said, if you look on top of that hardware store, you notice something interesting. You notice there's an old piece of stained glass that has a Magen David. That was the cheder. And we asked one old Polish man who had a good sense of humor, and he said, I'm not from here, I moved here, 40 years ago when the communists took over after the war, okay. Then we're walking right in front of that street, that cheder, right in front of that cheder, one of the highest streets in the town. And an old lady was across the street from us. And she sees a bunch of people wearing yarmulkes with their tzitzis out and ladies wearing shetels and long skirts. And we see her across. She's sort of pausing there, holding a bunch of shopping bags. Very elderly woman with a lot of shopping bags. Too much for an old lady to be carrying. So we figured we'll kill two birds with one stone. We'll offer to carry her shopping bags, and we'll engage her in conversation. I don't remember if we talked to her first or she sort of approached us, but our eyes locked across the street like she was looking at us, as if she wanted to tell us something, sort of waiting. So we came over to her, and then again, I don't remember if, you know, who started talking, but this is what she told us. I might have said this last year when I came back because it's so striking. She said, yeah, I remember when we had Jews in this town. I grew up here. And a few minutes later, she took us to the town, the house that she grew up in, that her family's been there for 80 years. Nothing changed in that house. It was a house, the same type of ovens that the Mishnah Berurah speaks about in Europe, the ovens that they had in the middle of the house to keep the house warm, that you could also heat up food on top of. The same exact oven she had. It wasn't the modern. She had a refrigerator also inserted with a line, an electricity line inserted also. But there was no bath in the house. It was a house from pre-war Europe that she still lived in with her older sister. But she said, I remember when there were Jews here. She wasn't offended by anything. She was, you know, very happy to... She wanted to share with us. It must have been a thought that was on her mind for 75 years, and now she had the opportunity to unload. When I was a little girl, living just around the corner from that cheder, two blocks from my father-in-law's house, during the war, there was a Jewish family. One of the neighbors had a five-year-old girl. A cute girl. I remember what she wore. And something happened to that family. She was young then, obviously. She was a little kid, a little older than a five-year-old. Maybe she was eight, maybe she was nine. And this family gave us their five-year-old daughter. And we had this five-year-old girl living with us. I don't know if it was a few days, I don't know if it was a few weeks. Because she couldn't be with her family, whatever that means. Until one of the other neighbors informed the authorities that this girl was with us, and then that five-year-old girl was taken from our family. I don't really know what happened to her. I think we all know what happened to her. You have to be pretty stupid to not know what happened to her. Her family, this lady I was talking to, five-year-old girl, maybe it was my father-in-law's second cousin, maybe not. An Eichon, Perek Dalet. Tovim hayu chalalei cherev mechalalei ra'av. Better off for those people who were killed by the sword than those who had to starve to death. Better to bleed to death. It's a lot faster than starving to death. There's a scholar, Holocaust scholar, Deborah Lipstadt, who points out something interesting about the Holocaust being in a class to itself. There are a lot of genocides throughout history. There are a lot of wars throughout history. Many millions of people died through that history. It was the only time in recorded history that a state tried to destroy an entire people, regardless of age, gender, location, profession, or belief. And the only instance in which perpetrators conducted this genocide for no ostensible material, territorial, or political gain. There's no reason. There's no reason. Not financial, not political. I want to share with you one story before we read the Kina. After about 15 minutes of bitter sobbing, the boy suddenly looked at me and asked whether I could teach him how to do tshuva. I was taken aback by his question and tried to comfort him. After the Gehenna you've been through, I said, you don't have to worry about doing tshuva. Your slate is clean. You're alive. You have to just get hold of yourself and stop worrying about doing tshuva. But my words had no effect. I couldn't convince him. He kept insisting, ich will tan tshuva. Ich muss tun tshuva. I want to do tshuva. I need to do tshuva. Finally, I said, what do you have to do tshuva for? And I was hoping that if he spoke about it, it would let go of some of the pain in his eyes. He pointed out the window and asked if I saw the gallows. When I said that, yes, I see the gallows outside the window, he began his story, which the Polish Jew subsequently confirmed in all the details. 2 months ago, one of the prisoners from this camp escaped. No one knew whether he was Jew or not. We were so caught up in our own survival, we didn't really bother to find out the name of the other people in our bunk. And one day the guards realized at roll call that one of the prisoners was missing, but they had no idea who, because roll call was by number, not by name. The camp commandant was so furious about the escape, he demanded to know the identity of this escaped prisoner, but nobody would provide him the information. In his fury, the commandant decided to play a sadistic game with us. He demanded any pair of brothers or father and son step forward. We were terrified of what he would do if we didn't comply, so my father and I stepped forward. They placed my father on a stool under those gallows and tied a noose around his neck. Once the noose was tied around his neck, the commandant cocked his Luger gun and placed it at my head and whispered, "If either you or your father doesn't tell me who escaped, you are going to kick out that stool from underneath your father's feet." I looked at my father and I told him, "Zorg sich nicht. Don't worry, Tati. I'm not going to do it." My father answered me, "My son, you have to do it. He's got a gun to your head, and he's going to kill you if you don't, and then he'll kick out the chair and we'll both be gone. This way, at least there's a chance you'll survive. But if you don't kick, we'll both be killed." "Tati, nein, ich will das nicht tun. I'm not going to do it. I haven't forgotten the mitzvah of Kibbutz." Instead of being comforted by my words, my father screamed at me, "I'm ordering you, I'm your father and I'm ordering you to kick out that stool. Nein, Tata, nein." My father got angrier, knowing that if I didn't obey him, he would just see his son murdered in front of his eyes. My father screamed, "You're talking about Kibbutz. This is your father's last wish. Listen to me. Kick out the stool under my feet." I was so frightened, I was so confused. After hearing my father scream, I kicked that chair and I watched my father. Can't read the rest of the words. Now tell me, do I have to do tshuva? Abanas Batkas, the Savimis of us, Lazarum, the Tapam, Shealadu, Gam, the Rabbos, Vivas, Nehobim, the Chayim, Mazal, and Ifrado, Estamam de Raj, Kisisa, Israel, shall call it up, Lelima, Trufim, Kanafshas, Mace, we may share with Ashay, Shafi, Famim, Alafim, Shlishi, Alafab, Raja, Zam, Soher. Koel Adam, Zach, et cetera, Maltim Chemi, Safix, Safta, Zahana, Kos, Rash, Sakos, Adim Lulatsa, Yorate Mayhem, the most prehem, Los Yashach, Mulanetsa, Kokil Gnicham, Yut Vicham, is today like Osa Klavim, Zahar, Safar. Not Hatsra, a day, Snakov, upon a Lubib. Machanos, a Puran cave, and a guy, the fate of Hashos, Abugumos, the first spot, the most rock, the Sakas, a Yamos, Ravam, Simam, Shikavam, Itzavam, Fishlan, and Shan Lichoy, Nakos, Halam, Mikoyakidum, Halil, Halish Kalach.
V'simras Hashem, Mikita, Mikivsham, Tilei, Tilei, Matzavas, Mikidim, V'chadrei Hara'al, Kol Shagos, Mikal, Nachnakim, Tavtei, Haidim, V'chon Gufas, Gviyas, Gufas, Gval Damrad, Mas, Natsim, V'chafu, Tarfeim, Livaris, Kaveyem, V'rish, Nikish, Yisrael, Nashim, Ritzas etzba sherosh yapras Livin shivut perach tzalma ves nisma Yorim yasach afrei abaras V'yisri chemen